Okay, welcome to this week's lecture. My voice, as you can hear, could be better. Just bear with me. So what we're going to talk about today is, and all of us are going to be doing active work for this, is what to keep in mind when writing a journal or a journal article or a chapter for an international publisher. Okay, and the first thing that I'm going to have you do relates to the homework for this class. So what I will want you to do is to get into groups of three, okay? Three persons only. If there's some people left over, you can be two or whatever. But or if there's only one person left over, you can be a group of four. But groups of three, I'm going to pass out paper. And based on the journal articles that you were looking at for last week and the week before, remember, my homework was to look at the structure of those journal articles, okay? And I hope that you at least have some kind of reference to them or access to them or some kind of memory of them. And together, you're going to answer these four questions. You're going to write your answers down on a piece of paper, and you are going to give me that piece of paper, so you need to have your names written on the piece of paper so that I know that you have participated. And this is, you know, I don't need you to go into a whole lot of depth, okay? We only have 25 minutes for this exercise. So I just want to get you thinking about how these kinds of articles and chapters are structured, okay? And to discuss among yourselves of what the differences are that you see, because there are going to be differences, probably, based on discipline or field or the type of journal. So to talk about those, and, oh, is somebody locked out here? Sorry about that, didn't realize it was locked. Keep it a little bit open there. Okay, so, and I'll be walking around in case you have questions, in case something up here is not very clear, so that you can ask me. And then I will also want to hear from you at the end. Starting about 15 minutes into the exercise, I will be going around to each group and sort of asking you what you're finding so far, okay? So it's not going to be like up here in front of the whole class kind of thing, but I will be really interested and genuinely interested in what you're finding, okay? So are there any questions before we start? If not, then get yourself into groups of three, and I will pass around the paper, and then you can get started, and I'll be walking around in case you have questions. Okay, so the small chance I had to talk with some of you, I found that there was, you know, some degree of similarity within your group, but also some differences, and also some differences from my own discipline. So that was useful. And I want to give you an idea that when you write an article or a chapter, that it could be useful for you to think about your article or chapter in terms of research questions and the answers to them. Now, in different fields, when you are writing an article, it might be framed, as some people were telling me, as a problem statement. Some journals would like you to talk about a hypothesis, and that might be more common in your field. And all of those problem statements, hypotheses, are very similar to research questions. But the reason that I would like to challenge you to think about your work in terms of research questions, actual questions with a question mark at the end, okay, is because it's easier to think about what you're actually doing in the article if you think about yourself answering a question, okay, or I would say maximum three questions, okay? So One question shows that the article or suggests that your article, your study is quite coherent. You have one question that you're going to answer. But sometimes you need more than one question. So I would say maximum three research questions, because if you start having more than three, it starts to look like you're doing too much. As Professor Oyala said in, I think it was a couple of lectures ago, that, you know, when you are trying to answer too many questions at the same time, the journal editors start to say, whoa, wait a second, this is too much. So I would say maximum three research questions. And you can think about your conclusions, and sometimes these are called discussions or implications. There's different ways that the journal will want you to label these conclusions. But basically, these will be mostly, I think, answers to your research question. Or at least in a convincing article, they will be answers to the research question. They can also be, as one of the groups pointed out, you know, ideas for future directions and this kind of thing. But I would say that particularly the answer to the research question. Now, because your answers to the research question should be convincing, you don't want to have a research question that's too large or too broad. You are not there to answer all the world's questions, okay? Your article basically represents one step forward for science. And we're all doing science, okay? We may not be biologists or physicists, but we're all doing science. Your article is one step forward to increase the information, the knowledge in your field, okay? So you don't need to answer lots of questions. Save those other questions that you have for other articles or other chapters in a book or in your own dissertation. And you can even save them for the postdoc phase if you are currently writing your dissertation. So the idea is that your research question should be narrow and specific, okay? So, and what do I mean by narrow and specific? I mean, talk about the precise data that you're using. You know, if you're studying only people living in Finland, say so in your research question. If you are only studying a certain time period, say so in your research question. If you are only studying a certain age group, say so in your research question. Otherwise, the research question could be misunderstood that you are studying everybody, and you won't have an answer for that. So be very specific. And remember that a reader is usually speed reading, gleaning through very fast your publication to try to find the message, okay? The useful message for them. So usually readers are a little bit less interested in background information, the kind of thing that we as researchers love usually. We want to give lots of background information. Look what we've found. Look at all this stuff we know. Look how interesting this is. Yes, definitely. But keep it short, and make sure that most of your article is about the main point or message that you are trying to get across, okay? And what you have discovered. What is the addition that you're making to your field, okay, in terms of knowledge, your main message, your key points? Okay, now, like I just said, background and introduction. In my view, keeping it short is the safe way to go. Of course, different fields have different ideas about this, but what I'm trying to give you is my best guess for a kind of overall model for how to write an effective article, okay? So remember that the reader is going to want to see in the first few sentences what your topic is. And what I mean is where, when, who are we studying? You know, what exactly is, because remember that if you are studying a particular culture, a particular set of people, a particular group, you are not going to be able to tell your reader about groups in general or cultures in general. You are going to be able to answer things about a specific topic, and you need to tell the reader how specific that is, and that's fine. In my view, the more specific, the better, okay? Your aim is not to prove to the reader that you are brilliant. Okay, that is not the aim of your article, is to show how smart you are or how intellectual you are. No. Your aim is to get a message across. Okay? Now, you can begin in the first few sentences of your article about what your topic is, or you can begin with why it is important. Okay? So choose one of those. Why should we care? Well, why should we be reading this article? Okay? You want to answer that in the first paragraph. So you can start with the topic, or you can start with why it's important. But once you've said the first thing in a few sentences, you immediately want to say in the next few sentences the other thing. Okay? So you want in your first paragraph both things. What is your topic and why should we care? Okay? And that's really important, this why should we care, because sometimes it's usually clear to us why it's important, but you need to tell your reader. They want to know. They're interested. Okay? Then, most of us probably will be using empirical data. Not all of us. Some of us might be studying research literature that somebody else has written and using that, maybe an overview. Sometimes you are writing literature overviews on a particular topic. In that case, the research literature that you have read is your data, in a sense. Okay, so, but some of us are using empirical data that we've collected ourselves, or that we've found, discovered in archives, or interviewed people, okay? So you want to tell the reader next, I think, about your data, because they really need to know that. They need to know what your data is in order to understand the rest of your article, okay? And you can discuss your data under the heading source materials or source data. You can talk about research setting and source data if you've gone somewhere outside of Uvascula to do your research, or source data and methodology. A lot of the groups that I talked to just now were saying that in the articles they read, there was not much attention given to methods or methodology. And I know that that is a challenge. So thinking about, you know, what kind of, not just what the data you used, but how did you get the data more specifically? And once you have that data in front of you, what do you do with it? Because another researcher could take that same data and come to completely different conclusions, okay? And that happens. So you need to tell, how did you interpret the data? What did you interpret it thematically, chronologically? How did you organize it? And how did you get the meanings out from the data? You need to tell the reader that. They just want to know. They are not there. They're not criticizing you about that usually. They just want to know how you did it so they can imagine in their own mind how you reached your conclusions. Okay? So, when you write your data section, my advice to you is start with an outward description only. And we are talking about how much data. Or how many people did you interview? When, where, who, that kind of description, okay? Don't yet, if you have a section that's called data or data and methodology, don't yet tell the content of your data. That's going to come in your analysis, okay? The actual substance of the meanings that you found in the data. Don't talk about that yet. It's easier if you start with a description, okay? And that's what the reader wants to know anyway. They want to know the sort of the outside description of what is your data like, okay? Now, remember that each type of data can only be used to answer certain kinds of questions. If I want to know whether HIV is increasing in Tanzania, 20 interviews in one place is not going to help me answer that question because it's only 20 interviews. However, conversely, there's also a problem with, you know, large-scale surveys. I could survey 1,000 people in Tanzania, but I'm not necessarily going to find out that way the easiest what people feel about HIV, how it relates to their experiences, their motives, their emotions, their attitudes. Okay, that for that, I might want to interview 20 people instead of 1,000 people surveyed. So, as is probably obvious to all of you, certain data can only answer certain kinds of research questions. And so what you will do is you will tell the reader first what type of data you have, just like I said in the very first part there, and then you are going to tell your research questions so that it makes sense to the reader, okay? And your reader will be looking carefully and asking, how do your research questions and the answers to those questions fit your data, okay? So are you asking the right questions based on your data? Okay, that's important. So you'll tell your reader how you got the data, how you went out and collected it. That's part of methodology, okay? So they can imagine themselves doing the same thing. Okay, so let's talk about methodology. Remember that methodology always refers to two separate things. Okay, now they're not separate necessarily in the way you did it, but they are what we could call analytically separate. And analytically separate means that when we start to really think about them from an analytical point of view, okay, analytically separate, that we start to think about them and we treat them as different things. So, first of all, we have the process and tools that you use to collect your data, okay? And then we have the process and tools that you use to analyze your data. Now, for many of us, like people in my field, we think, oh gosh, we don't have processes or tools to use to analyze our data. We just do it. We just read it, and then we get the meanings. Yeah? Until recently, that's what we thought we were doing. But what you're really doing is something different. You are using the processes and tools in your mind to analyze and to interpret the data in a particular way. And you simply need to ponder that, to think about that, and write it out clearly for the reader how you are thinking. Now, for each person, that's going to be different. And it's very subjective if that's the kind of field that you're working in. Some of you are working in fields where you know what the tools are or the processes are. You've learned certain tools and processes, and so in that case, you will write that out. But try to explain it for the reader, because not all readers will be as familiar with those tools as you are. So you do want to give some simple explanation of those. Excuse me. So what you really want to do, if you feel that I'm just doing close reading in Finnish lähiluku, I'm just doing a close reading of my data, but there's something going on in your close reading. There's certain assumptions that you're coming to the data with. There's certain ways that you're seeing it. And often those assumptions will be similar to maybe other people working in the same department as you. So discuss with them. Discuss with them about what are the different things that you're doing with the data. When we have especially large amounts of data, we need to organize those first somehow. Okay. Otherwise, as we all know, large amounts of data are very difficult to analyze if you don't organize them. They can be organized chronologically in terms of time, thematically in terms of theme or topic. But, you know, explain to the reader what you've done, and I think that's important. Okay? And you can describe that sometimes. You can have a separate section called methodology, or you can describe that in a section called data and methodology, depending on what your journal wants. Okay. All right, then we come to analysis, okay? And you can call this section analysis, or you can call it something else, but it's good for you to think about it as analysis. So basically, this is going to be maybe sometimes in very short articles, it might just be one section, but sometimes if you have a bit more space, you might have 2 to 4 kind of thematic sections, and you put the theme at the top. But it's good for you to think about them that these are analysis sections, because you are going to now analyze your data. You are now going to look at the content and the meanings inside of your data, okay? So you will, well, you don't always tell one simple story, but this is my advice to you, is tell one simple story. One story that's kind of a linear. It starts from here and it goes to here. It starts from A and it goes to Z. Okay? Why? Because this will be the easiest for your reader to understand and grasp. And believe me, what you really want when you are publishing internationally is for other people to understand your work. If they don't understand it, they will not cite you. They will not spread it to their colleagues. Make sure they understand it, okay? And that means that sometimes we have to choose to sound less intellectual, less flowery. Sometimes we love this very flowery, beautiful language that we want to use when we're writing, but we can't really do it because a reader in another country may not understand us, okay? You are not writing, when you're writing international articles, you are not writing just for Finnish people or just for people in your own country. You are writing for the world. And the world is a lot of people. It's a lot of people in India. It's a lot of people in China. It's a lot of people in the US and North America, South America, whatever. You need to make sure that you are writing clearly also for them, because the citation academia is now global. Okay, so think about that. So if you're telling one simple story and you're telling it clearly, that usually causes many of us pain. Okay, we feel pain because we had so many stories to tell. We had so many great ideas that we wanted to put into this article. Don't do it. Don't do it. Tell yourself, I'm going to tell one simple story in this article, and I'm going to save my other stories for other articles. Okay? And that's truly the way in which you will publish fastest, in my limited experience of this. Okay? Now, we're going to get to how to decide about, you know, what do I tell for this article and what do I tell for other articles. I'll get to that in a moment. But what I want to say next is, remember that the things that you've found out, the answers to your research questions are going to seem so clear to you, so obvious, but they are not going to seem that clear to your reader. So it's important that you give your reader evidence, that you prove your point to your reader. Now, if you are a historian or an ethnologist, there's maybe no way to prove your interpretation to a reader, but if you set the whole thing up so that you show your data, you show how you interpreted your data, and you give evidence, you know, little excerpts from your data, possibly. In some fields, people don't do that as much, but in my field, we give quotes from interviews or excerpts, you know, bits from the archive data that we're using to show that, you know, I just didn't dream this up, you know, that I have evidence for this. So you want to make sure that you're doing that in your article, very important, so that the reader can be convinced about your research conclusions, okay? Now, all of the things I'm saying here also work if you're writing a monograph dissertation. You can use very much the same format, usually, depending on your field, okay? You might label some of these areas that I'm talking, you might label them differently, but I think the basic setup is very similar through most of the fields that are in our faculty, okay? So let's go to article dissertations, and how does one structure your article dissertations? So I have never written an article dissertation. I admit that I am not the best expert on this. However, I've talked to a lot of people when I was vice dean and I was helping people apply for research funding. A lot of people who were writing article dissertations came to me and said, you know, how do I, in my research application, how do I talk about these different articles? And what I feel is a useful way to structure your article dissertation is to tell the reader of your article, and later when you make the dissertation ready, tell the reader that each article answers your main research question from a different perspective or answers a sub-question of your main research question. So you still have your main research question. I'm going to call it RQ here. Okay, there's your research question. But now you can think about each article kind of takes on a different task, because any research question can be approached from different angles using slightly different data or slightly different methods or slightly different aspects, sub-questions from this main research question. So you can have each article then contributing to that research question. Now, I know that for some of you who have already written your articles, you've already done your analysis, you're thinking, oh no, I didn't really set it up that way, and I'm not sure how I'm going to argue that. There is always a way that you can argue it, okay? A lot of what we do as research is also advertisement. It's also giving a sales pitch, a moon tipuhe. Okay, you have to show the reader that, you know, what I originally had in mind was this idea, and, you know, every article does somehow kind of answer that question. And if you're having problems thinking about, okay, what is the main research question that drives my dissertation, sometimes it's good to just sit and think about what was the original spark, the kipina in Finnish, what was the original thing that got you interested in this topic in the first place? There, usually, we can find a main research question inside of ourselves if we just go back and think. It's hard for us after a couple of years of working on it, or 5 years, 7 years working on the research. It's hard to remember what was the spark that got me interested in this topic in the first place. But sometimes that's where you will find a really good unifying research question, okay, is thinking about, gosh, you know, this topic got me interested for some reason in the beginning, and what was that reason, okay? So that's just to give you an idea. Now, it is easier to show the reader, I mean, usually with a dissertation, we want it to look coherent, okay? Keep that in mind when you are writing either a monograph or an article dissertation. Coherence is really important. And having one main research question helps to keep the whole dissertation coherent. Having one main research question for your article that you're publishing helps to keep that article coherent. Ehjä in Finnish, okay? Unified. Very important. Okay, so when you are writing the introduction or the compilation, we're still talking about article dissertations. When you're writing the introduction or compilation section, the main section that you have to write after your articles are written for your dissertation, you will probably need to include in that section the main research question for your whole dissertation. Okay, that would be useful. Possibly a brief summary of the whole answer that you have to that question. Okay, because after you've published or at least written your articles for your article dissertation, you know, the reader's going to want, okay, they want to know, what's the take-home message of these articles? You know, are they all on something completely different, or is there kind of something that they're all talking about and you want to tell your reader that, okay? What have you found based on writing these articles, okay? And then you probably will need to put more background information, more in-depth description of your data, more methodology, more theory, and sometimes that's because, or often that's because in a journal article, you don't have space to go into very much depth about your data, about your theory, about your methodology. So for an article dissertation, when you're writing the introductory part, you are going to want to tell more, probably, or in greater depth. Not always, but it depends. So if you have one core umbrella question that can be logically broken down into the parts that are answered in your article, then it becomes easier to see what you need to write in the introduction, okay? So when you're writing the introduction to your article dissertation, you have to think about the fact that everything should ideally revolve around your research question. And I'm going to talk about that in a moment. What does it mean that it revolves around the research question? Okay? So here we go. Why is the research question the central core of any dissertation? Because in an ideal dissertation, all of your justifications, and what do I mean by justifications? I mean the why questions. Why did I do this? Why did I choose this? Why did I do it this way and not another way? Those are justification answers that you're going to be giving. So they all go back to the research question. What do I mean? When you're describing your source data, an ideal dissertation tells the reader why this particular type of data was the best possible one for answering your research question, okay? So That's the ideal way to think about your data. Why was this the best data for answering my research question? Likewise, your theories and methods of analysis should be the best possible tools for answering your research question, okay? So you can say, well, I use this tool, I organize the data thematically because this helps me best answer my research question, or I focused on key elements, or I organized it chronologically because this best helps me answer my research question. So again, I'm talking about ideal dissertations. Most dissertations don't think this way, but this will help you write. It will help you save time in writing if you are thinking about what you are writing as a justification, as an answer to why. Why did you choose to do it that way? Okay? And if you constantly have your research question in mind, I want each of you to memorize your research question, okay? The research question with a question mark that is driving your dissertation, because if you can memorize it, if you constantly have it in mind, no matter what you are writing, when you are writing the introduction to your article dissertation, when you are writing your description of your data, your methods, whatever you're writing, your theory, that you constantly think to yourself, is this relevant to my research question? Is it helping me answer my research question? Because if it's not, do not include it in your dissertation. The way in which people kind of lose the most time when they are writing a dissertation, or this also holds for journal articles, the way that people lose the most time is they start going off on some track, on some idea that does not relate to their research question, and you get lost that way. It's an endless swamp, okay? So, because, you know, 30 years ago it didn't matter, because 30 years ago people had 20 years to write their doctoral dissertation, and now you have four. You have 4 years, if I'm talking to doctoral students here, and some of you are postdocs, you've already been through it, but you have 4 years, and so I'm trying to help you efficiently use this time, and I really urge you to memorize your research question and constantly focus on it, okay? So that's why it's the core, and your answers, your goal is to answer that research question, not to do anything else, okay? Again, not to show how much you've learned, because your dissertation nowadays is not to show how much you've learned, it's to answer a question, okay? So keep that in mind, and you won't get lost, hopefully. Now, I'm going to give, in this last part of my lecture, I'm going to give some general tips for writing in English, because I know that apparently none of you have English as your native language. And as I said before, I've been extremely lucky that English was my native language. I've also worked as a proofreader and a translator from Finnish for about 10 years while I was finishing my doctoral dissertation and so forth. So I have a lot of tips for you, okay? And some of them I'm sure many of you already know, but just in case. So one thing that I think, especially I've talked to Finns who say that they didn't, that the same is not true for Finnish, but in academic English, the most important sentence in a paragraph, and we're talking about the main message that you have now in this paragraph, what you really want to say in this paragraph should go in the first sentence or the last sentence. Do not bury it in the middle of your, do not bury it in the middle of your paragraph, okay? So you have a longer paragraph, and let's say you have 5 sentences in that paragraph. Make sure that your main message goes at the beginning or the end of the paragraph. That's the way that people in the U.S. at least are taught to write, and that's the way that people who are taught English are looking. When they are reading your articles, they are looking for that main message to be in the first or the last sentence, okay? So remember that. And also, just as you don't want to bury your main message in the middle of your paragraph, you don't want to bury your main message in the middle of your section. So by section, I'm talking about maybe your data section, your conclusions. Again, put it at the beginning or the end. Preferably the beginning, okay? Don't bury good ideas that are, for example, your conclusions. One thing I often see in dissertations when I'm reading dissertations is that people bury really important conclusions that they have somewhere in the middle of their introduction or the middle of their analysis. Don't hide it for the reader. Make it easy for the reader to find, okay? Now, and likewise, don't give away your conclusions already in your introduction. A lot of people put a lot of background information into their introduction of their dissertation, for example. Now I'm talking about dissertation. And they don't realize that a lot of that background information is things that they themselves have discovered. You know, don't put that in your introduction. That's not background information. Background information is what you read from someone else's research, okay? What you've read in the research literature. If it's your idea based on your data, or an idea that you had when you read the research literature and you thought, oh, wow, I could put that all together. That's not background. That's a conclusion. That's a research conclusion. You want to tell that in your analysis and make it very clear in your conclusions, okay? And a lot of people I see, they kind of throw away their own ideas in the introduction. And the readers think that you've gotten that from someone else. They will not give you credit for it if they find it in the introduction. So that's important. Know what, you know, what are the ideas you've come up with, and realize that those are conclusions. And you will summarize those in the end, in the conclusions. Now, pay attention to segues. What are segues? Segues are bridges. They are a sentence that serves as a thematic bridge from one idea to another. What I see a lot happens in English, especially for people who are English is not their native language, because it's difficult to write in a language that's not your native language, is that sometimes people jump from topic to topic. So they were talking about this, and suddenly in the next sentence they're talking about something else. Readers don't like that, okay? And editors don't like that. Reviewers don't like that. So make sure that if you are jumping from topic to topic, you know what the relationship between those two topics is. Why are you talking about this and then this? And then tell that relationship in a segue sentence. Make up a sentence that leads the reader from one topic to the next. Okay? That's very important in English. Now, the other thing is that make sure your titles and your subtitles are informative, not poetic, not beautiful, not super intellectual, but informative. If you are giving your analysis, call it an analysis section. If you are talking about data, call it a data section. If you are dealing with a particular theme, then call, you know, make your subheading inside of your article, call it what it is in very simple language. Go back after you've written the text and make sure that all of the titles inside of your article are actually, you know, describing what you're doing in that section, because that happens to me. It happens to everybody. Everyone is blind to their own texts, okay? And readers need those titles because many times, as I said before, they're speed reading them on the internet. You know, when you're looking for data, when you're looking for useful research literature, many of us go to Google and we're just speed reading through, and we want informative titles, okay? And if it's informative, people might use your article, they might cite it, they might tell their colleagues about it. Okay, now we get to the question of spoken versus academic English. Now, the first thing to avoid is dramatic bits in your text. You know, very much. You know, this is very, very significant. No, you don't need to, all you have to do is say, this is significant, and you have your message across, okay? Right now, as you see in my text, I have these little quotation marks around. A lot of reviewers call those shouting quotations, and they tell you not to shout at them, okay? So you don't need those most of the time. If it's a quote, of course you need it, and then you'll give the citation, you'll give where that quote's coming from. If it's, you know, if you want to show that you're not completely dedicated to that idea, like if you're saying that, you know, you're talking about a group and you're saying someone else had said something bad about that group and you want to show your distance from that, like you're saying that these people are, you know, lazy. Okay, you could put quotes around lazy to show that you don't think they're lazy. Someone else thought they were lazy. That's fine, but use those very minimally, okay? Use them very little in your article, okay? Now, don't use the word we in your article because the reader may not agree that you and he are in, or you and she are in the same group, okay? It's not a universal we, you know? So if you're talking about I collected this data, use I. And if you can also use passive voice. Sometimes people ask me, should I use passive voice like the data was collected? Or should I use that I collected the data? I would say that right now in the English academic world, it's about half and half split, okay? And it depends also on what field you are in. In some fields, it's more common to use the passive voice. In some fields, it's more common to use the active voice. I know that for feminist studies and gender studies, there's a push towards using I because you should take responsibility for the research you're doing. Now, if you are in a field where there's a lot of talk about responsibility, for example, anthropology is one of those fields, you might want to use I because it shows that you are not just kind of making it all fuzzy about who did this research. You're actually taking responsibility. That's fine. However, other fields, it's not considered, you know, proper to use the I form. So find out from your supervisors and other colleagues what, and you can read in journals, obviously, you can see what other people are doing. But I would say it's about half and half, 50-50. So there's not one or right or wrong group. However, I would say that if you start using one form in your article, use it for the whole article. Don't shift between, you know, the data was collected and then I did something else, you know. So use either passive or, as we could say, active first person form. Use either, but not both in your article. Okay, and then use clear and precise words that you really know the meaning of. Because what happens typically, this happens to me, I use some beautiful flowery word even in English, and then I realize like 2 years later after my article's published, wait a second, I didn't actually understand what that word meant. And that happens really easily in English because English has, the words have very specific nuances, and that nuance could be different in British English to American English to Indian English. So it's really best to write concretely and clearly and use simple words that, you know, people probably are not going to misunderstand, okay? It's just I feel that that's the safe way to go, is writing in a simple, clear way, okay? Now, don't write things like, I suggest, I propose, somewhat, maybe, perhaps. All of these are what we call qualifiers. You're not sure about what you're saying. So you're kind of, you know, maybe, yeah, somewhat. I suggest, don't do that. Stand behind your work and make a statement, okay? That's usually, I think reviewers have said that to me, and so I say it to you. Be clear and firm in what you want to say, okay? So just remove the qualifiers. Now, if you are suggesting at the end of your article, you know, you can't prove it, but possibly this might be true. You can say that, but say it at the end of your article in the conclusions, you know, sort of possibly or potentially or something. But don't do that when you're giving your analysis, okay? Now, also, don't do what I call superfluous prefacing, which is very typical, I think, for Finnish language speakers, that when they write in English and also when they write in Finnish, that they say, and next, I'm going to tell you about this, or, you know, in my next chapter, don't do that. You don't have to tell the reader what you're going to do, just do it, okay? First of all, you'll save a lot of space. You'll save the reader's time. Just do it. So don't say that, you know, and in this article, I will show you. No, just show it, okay? So that's, you may get different advice from your supervisors, but I really feel that kind of a best guess for English is just write it, okay? And do not use future tense will when you're writing your article or dissertation or chapter in English. Don't say, you know, this dissertation will show. No. Just say, I show here. Use present tense. This is where Finns have the easy, because there is no future tense in Finnish. So just use present tense as if you were meaning future. Only in academic English. You do need will, you know, when you're talking to people. But for academic English, don't use it. Use present tense. Say, I argue this in this paper rather than I will argue. Okay? Now, avoid words that are commonly used only in spoken English. So, for example, when I told you today to get into groups, okay, that get, that's spoken English, okay, and I can tell you that when I'm speaking to you. But if I was writing that in a paper, I would say organize yourselves into groups, okay? Get is not academic English. So you could use, like if you mean get to obtain, you would use obtain. Get is one of the most frequently used verbs in English. It means all kinds of things. If you think about how people use the word get. So it's very vague, and think specifically what you want to say and use a slightly more precise word for what you want. Do not use contractions. Don't, isn't, can't. We use those all the time in spoken English. They don't belong to academic English. You can say do not, is not, cannot. Okay? You can put them on blogs or web pages. That's fine, because those are a little bit more informal. But for academic writing, for writing a journal article, don't use contractions. Words like, as a proofreader, I come a lot across words like little or big. Those are more spoken language words, which a lot of times people who don't speak English as a native language, they don't realize that it's more of a spoken language. So I would use small instead of little, large instead of big, or if you're talking about big conclusions, you know, significant conclusions or significant differences rather than big differences, okay? Then in English, at least I think this is different from Finnish, that in Finnish it's okay to use the same word or same root word over and over in one paragraph. Not in English. In English we need variation, okay? That's considered good English. So, I'm giving you a list of things that just came to my mind of synonyms that you could use. If you want to express the same thing, for example, in the same section, you sort of run out of words. Okay, first of all, your best friend is the thesaurus. www.thesaurus.com. I use it every day. This will give you all the synonyms you ever needed. Okay? However, it is difficult to know what the different nuances of the synonyms are. And for that, I don't know. You know, one thing is you can pick a word and look at how Google uses it. I mean, like, look at all the hits on Google. How are people using that word? You know, what are the nuances? I do that with Finnish a lot when I'm not sure, am I using the right word in Finnish? I just Google it and try to figure out how other people have used it. So, but things like however, nevertheless, nonetheless, yet, but, they all mean the same thing, and you should not start your sentence with things like but. But you can start a sentence with yet, or however, nevertheless, nonetheless. Examine, analyze, investigate, clarify, discuss, take a closer look at. You can use all of those. They usually, generally, when you're talking about kind of academic argumentation, they use that. They mean very similar things. Then when you're making a stance, you're stating something, you can, or someone else, you could say, your scholar so-and-so argues, states, posits, explains, makes clear, clarifies, etc. That's when a scholar makes a point. And commonly, generally, usually, typically, when you want to emphasize something or stress it, you can highlight, underscore, emphasize, or stress it. Something is important, significant, valuable, thought-provoking. And one of the things I want to say is that I see sometimes people writing, and they keep using over and over again, according to, you know, professors, don't use academic titles, but according to John Smith, you know, who wrote in 1990, and then they, you know, a few sentences they use again, according to, only use that once, because it looks very repetitive if you use according to again and again. There's lots of other ways you can do that. You can just say, you know, that, you know, HIV rates in Uganda have skyrocketed. And you don't have to say according to somebody. Just put the citation at the end of the sentence. You know, that's enough, okay? Or you can say that, you know, Mary Smith states that, you know. So there's different ways that you can say this, and you don't have to say according to all the time, okay? Now, I'm going to give you, because I know that, let me see how many more slides we have. Yep, 4 more slides, okay. And then I'll take questions. So, I know that many of you are thinking, wow, I've been told I need to publish. I've been told I need to publish fast. And also, as was mentioned in class, I think on the first lecture, sometimes you only have 5,000 words to work with. The journal wants you to write a very short article. So how can you do this? So I am going to, here's my list for speed writing of research articles. Now I realize that for some of you and some of your disciplines, you know, you're going to have to adapt this a little bit. You're going to have to change it a little bit, okay? But this is my idea for how to save your time. And I am now currently using this when I write my own articles, and it has helped me. So I just speak from experience. First of all, think about, you've got your data, you've read through your data, you've started to make kind of interpretations of your data. Think about all of the conclusions or main points or main messages that you could possibly write about from your data. Just list them, okay? Group them into different themes where you have only 3 points or conclusions per theme. So you say, okay, this theme is about, if I'm thinking about my own data, I think, oh, this theme is about sexuality. This theme over here, this is about child marriage, okay? Group them according to theme where you only have 3 conclusions that you're making per theme. If you've got more than conclusions, that divide it again into 2 separate themes, okay? So you're thinking about all these things you could say. Now you group them into themes with 3 conclusions or points per theme. Then I want you to choose one, okay? One, you could only choose one theme for this article, okay, that you're going to be writing. Okay, you choose one, you leave the others for future articles, and you write a rough draft. First you have to make research questions. So now you have your theme. Now I want you to think of research questions. What could be the possible research questions from that theme? That is the most important first step, because we talked about the importance of the research question, its core. Think about research questions from that theme. Then I want you to write your conclusions first. Okay, after you have your research question, don't worry about writing the introduction, the data, not yet, okay? Write your conclusions, a rough draft. The rough draft could simply be these, as we say in Finnish, ranskalais, viivat, in English we say dashes, okay? So, you know, blah, 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 an idea. Blah, 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 an idea for a conclusion, blah, 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 blah. Well, you've already thought of that you could have 3 conclusions for that theme, so write those down, and then start to fill them out a little bit, write a little bit more text, you know, until you've got some kind of rough draft of the conclusions. This will help you. It will help you to know where you're going, okay? Because otherwise, when you start writing an article, you end up going, and you're not quite sure what the conclusion is going to be. That's the worst way it's just the worst experience of writing an article, okay? Then, after you have a rough draft of your conclusions, you're going to write the source data section. And remember, it's just the description. It's just the who, where, you know, what is the data, where, when, who. Write that description, okay? And here I'm showing you the number of pages, because 5,000 words, double-spaced, is about 17 pages, okay? So I'm trying to, if you had to do it in 17 pages, if you had to do it in 5,000 words, how many pages should you devote to each section? And this is just my best guess for you, okay? So your source data section, 1 to 2 pages. Your rough draft of your conclusions, 1 to 2 pages, very short. And then you're going to write the methodology parts. So what were the methods that you used to collect your data and also analyze it? Okay, now that can also be part of your source data section if that's easiest for you. That's fine. In which case, that whole section would be a maximum of 4 pages. Okay? Then you write the analysis that's logically going to lead the reader to accept your conclusions. Your analysis is basically leading your reader from your research question to your research answers. Okay? Your analysis is simply step by step. You are giving them evidence. You are showing them how your thinking is going, your argumentation, and you are going to write that. Do that after. This is all in order of how I want you to do this. Okay? So that's 6 to 10 pages. And then you, at the very end, you write your introduction. Because once you have everything else written, your analysis, your data, then you have to think. Then you let it rest for a couple of weeks. You know, don't look at it for 2 or 3 weeks. Go back. And then go back and read it. And then think to yourself, if I was reading this for the first time, what would I need to know in terms of background information to understand what I'm even talking about? So for me, I would have to tell people a little bit about Tanzania, where I've done field work. Or I'd have to tell them a little bit about, you know, the kind of sexuality, early marriage themes that I'm looking, you know, I need to give them some background. And for that, we go back to what I talked about before. Tell them what your topic is. Tell them why it's important in the first paragraph. Okay, so that's going to be your first paragraph, which you are going to write after you have written all of these other things. Because it will be easier to see why this is important or how to summarize your topic once you know what you've found out, what are your conclusions, how you've written your analysis. Okay, so these go in the beginning, and that's 1 to 2 pages. And then you've got your bibliography or your list of literature references, 3 pages. That is kind of my best guess for how to help you write an article. People are different, so if your mind works differently from what I'm showing, fine, trust your mind. You know, trust yourself, trust your instincts always. Some people want to have it all in their head, and then they want to write it down all in one go. Okay? I think Professor Oyola talked about this before. Other people make 20, 30 drafts of the same article and just make small changes each time they reread it. That's me. Okay? I seriously, it takes at least 20 drafts for me to write an article. If that's the way your mind works, go with that. But this is just kind of my best guess for how to help you. Okay. Now, how do we know whether 2 articles are sufficiently different to be separate publications? I told you to leave some of these other themes for future articles. But I know that a lot of you, as also I myself, we start to wonder that, oh no, if 2 articles are similar, you know, are the editors, they're going to find out this is plagiarism, what do we do? So I hope that your supervisors, or possibly the other lecturers in this, Professor Ahonen, who's going to be talking to you next, I mean, they may weigh in, I hope they will, and give their own ideas, because there are really different ideas about this. But my idea from talking to editors is that a minimum criteria for what makes a different journal article could be, or if you have like a chapter in a journal article, is that you have different research questions and different answers to those questions, right? They should be different for each article. The text, the actual text and kind of what it's saying should be at least 50% different in the different articles. And no paragraphs should be exactly the same text. You might have a sentence that's exactly the same text, okay? And you can, and remember that if you've already published one article, you can always refer to yourself so that you don't self-plagiarize. So if myself, if I've written one article, and then I can, in the next article, I can say Stark 2017 when I'm using that same sentence. You know, especially when you're talking about your data and methods, they probably are going to be the same or similar for several articles, especially for dissertation articles, but also when you're a postdoc. So, of course, a lot is going to be very similar, but either refer to yourself, to what you've already published, so that you can't be accused of self-plagiarism, or make sure that the sentences, the paragraphs, that the same thing is said in different ways. I had this problem when I was sending 2 articles to different journals on the same topic at the same time. So I couldn't refer to myself, and I really thought, oh, and I really had to go through and make sure that I had changed the text so that it was, you know, I was saying very similar things, but in a different way. Both of those articles are published now Nobody said anything, we hope, you know, that somebody doesn't say, oh, wow, these are... But I did have different research questions, and I did have different conclusions. And so they were serving different functions. And I think that's what you need to think about, is that your articles are serving different functions, okay? And when you get stuck when you're writing, remember, all of us get stuck. All of us feel like, oh, I don't want to go back to that article manuscript because I just feel like it's not going forward. All that happens to all of us. What I have learned over the past, 30 years, is that you have three sources of inspiration, and use them. Use them so they help you get unstuck, okay? The first is your research literature, and I don't mean keep finding new articles or new books to read. I don't mean that. I mean go back to what you have already read, because all of us, when we, I think this is true probably for all of us, when we read articles and books, we think, oh yeah, I remember what that book says. No, you don't. You know, books are big. Go back, read it again. Read articles again. If you go back and read them over again, you will find new inspiration, I guarantee you. The same thing for your source data. We all think after we've read our source data through a couple of times that we know what's there. But if you have large enough data, which most of us do, you go back, I guarantee you. This is, I'm speaking 30 years of experience. Every time I've said, no, I know my source data, when I force myself to go back and read it, I find amazing new things that, you know, the first time just didn't stick in my brain. Read your source data again. And read the texts that you have written so far. Give it a rest, 2 or 3 weeks, go back to it, and you will see it with new eyes, okay? Those are your sources of inspiration. Use them to not get stuck, okay? And so, you know, make yourself, if you are writing your dissertation, make yourself every day or several times a week, make yourself go back and look at these things. I don't mean that you constantly have to go back and read the research. If you feel that your writing is going fine, then you don't have to do this. But if you feel you're stuck, then I really recommend it. Okay, this is the last slide, and then I'm going to take questions. So my last advice to you is become a reviewer. Okay? When you submit an article manuscript, some journals, and I think increasingly this is happening, some journals ask immediately, oh, you've submitted a manuscript. Can you be a future reviewer for us? And you might feel like, oh, wow, I haven't even published. You know, I don't know. Do I have time? And I don't know if I'm qualified. Yes, you are qualified. Yes, say yes, always. Being a reviewer will teach you so much. It will teach you things that I can't, you know, tell you here in a lecture. So please become available to be a reviewer wherever you can. Or if it's, you know, if it's in a journal that's run by students, or if it's in a, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. Be a reviewer. Because when you start looking and you have to look critically at other people's article manuscripts, you will start to think about this in a whole new way. That's what happened to me. I assume it happens to most people. So just be a reviewer. Okay, so that's my end of my lecture for today. And I'm happy to take any questions, and I'll give the microphone to anyone who has questions on anything that we've done today or talked about today.
Yes, about this last one. If I would become a reviewer and review something, can I point that out in my CV, or is that going to be a... Or yes. How to do that?
Yes, you can. You can put a section in your CV of, you know, reviewing journal articles. That's especially useful for younger scholars, junior scholars, people who don't, you know, once you've published a lot of articles or books, you may not need to do that anymore. But when you're starting out, absolutely, yes. And just put, you know, you don't put the actual name of the article or the people if you've seen them. But, you know, put that for this journal, I've been a reviewer, you know, once or twice or, you know, or whatever. And you can list all the journals that you've been a reviewer for. So I don't see any problem with that. Other questions? Everything is crystal clear? Yeah, okay. The question is, are the slides? Yes, the slides will be on Moodle, so I will have those there. Other questions? Yes.
My question is on when you're writing a review article, because you spoke about article and then you talk about data and everything, but you didn't do much on review article. So if you're going to write a review article before you go to your main research questions, in this case, do you have any kind of tips?
I don't. I admit that I have actually very seldom or never written a review article, and I would say that that's probably going to be specific to your field, to your discipline, so that it's probably best if you are asked to do a review article, look at what other review articles in similar journals look like, or ask your supervisor, because I know that it's different in different disciplines. That's why I didn't talk about it here, but it's a good question. Okay, so if there's no other questions, then we're finished for today, and thank you. And